Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, neighbors, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone. In George Herbert Walker Bush used to call Little Beirut, also known as the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, airamericaradio.com, CRN Digital, also on Sirius Satellite Radio and on radio stations from coast to coast. Welcome to our program. It is Friday. It's the first hour of our program. Typically, we have Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Today, he's not available. He's got some stuff he's got to attend to. But here we are. So I want to share with you some extraordinary stories in the news. This from the St. Petersburg Times. St. Petersburg, Florida. St. Petersburg, Florida. Councilmember Ed Taylor won re-election Tuesday by massive landslides. Okay, so sounds good. Now, who's the guy he ran against? He ran against a fellow by the name of Cook, Marshall Cook. And Marshall Cook received a small percentage of the vote. I think that there's probably a consensus, regardless of what happened, that Marshall Cook lost. He won 19.5% of the vote that Cook lost. Taylor won 80.5% of the vote. But Cook had some problems with this. Cook ran a campaign, first of all, that touted the opportunity for change. This is from Ann Lindbergh's article in St. Petersburg Times. As the election neared, Cook complained about the placement of Mishler's signs, saying they were illegally placed on public rights of way, although city officials traditionally allow political signs there during the last week or so of the election season. And on election day, Cook charged that the voting machines malfunctioned in several precincts, including his own precinct at Skyview Recreation Center. When Cook tried to vote for himself, the machine defaulted to a vote for Taylor. A precinct worker finally moved Cook to a different booth. Later in the day, Cook said he had other reports of voting machines malfunctioning in similar ways. Nancy Whitlock, communication director for the Pinellas County Supervisor of Elections Office, said there had been a problem at Cook's precinct. One machine, she said, registered a different answer when voters touched it. Poll workers recalibrated it to fix the problem. Whitlock said she did not know how many people had voted before the problem was caught, but she said nobody else complained, so she didn't think it affected a lot of votes. Now, according to Brad Friedman over at Brad Blog, these machines in Pinellas County, Florida, are the same paperless touchscreen machines made by Sequoia Voting Systems that were used in New Mexico, recently banned in that state as a result of a lawsuit from voters claiming vote flipping. The exact same thing, saying these votes are moving. And the same machines was lost more than 12,000 votes in Barnello County, New Mexico, in 2002. And so, interesting. Now, that's election story one. Election story two, in Burlington, Vermont, where we're on the air right now, in WVAA. In Burlington, Vermont, Bob Kiss, a progressive state representative, but a newcomer to city politics, was elected mayor of Burlington on Tuesday, defeating Republican city councilor Kevin Curley and Democratic state senator Hinda Miller. Now, this is interesting because this is the first election in the city's history where they used instant runoff voting. And instant runoff, and they actually had to go to the second round. None of the candidates got a majority in the first round. There were apparently five or six people running for this office. And the fellow won, Bob Kiss, a 58-year-old former anti-poverty agency executive and a progressive, running as a progressive, not as a Democrat or a Republican, running as a progressive for mayor of Burlington, which, by the way, was Bernie Sanders' old job before he went to the House of Representatives years ago. And they say because no candidate had won a majority, the instant runoff voting system came into play, and that rolled over a second round where the bottom few candidates' votes dropped off, and when the way instant runoff voting goes is, just to so that I'm using names that you're familiar with, let's say that it was the election of 2000, and I wanted to vote for candidate, let's say I wanted to vote for Ralph Nader, but really I wanted, you know, I figured that Al Gore would win. So if I had instant runoff voting, I could vote for Ralph Nader as my first choice and then make Al Gore my second choice and then, you know, designate no third choice. And so what would happen is they would do the vote, and if nobody won a clear majority, if neither Bush nor Gore nor Nader won a clear majority, they would say, okay, whoever got the fewest number of votes, we're going to drop them off the ballot and go to the second vote that everybody placed who for all the people who voted for that person we dropped off. So Nader would have been dropped off the ballot because he only got 3%. And all of the second choice votes for Nader. And Nader's claim has been ever since 2000 that as many Republicans voted for him as Democrats, and therefore he didn't influence the election. I don't buy it, but that's his claim. And so anyhow, my Nader vote would have become an Al Gore vote if there was instant runoff voting. What instant runoff voting does is it allows third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties and other parties to get involved in the electoral system and in the electoral process without creating a situation where it's not possible for there to be partisan politics. You know, you can still have political parties, and yet it opens the process up so you can have more than two parties, basically, because we have right now in the United States a system that's fundamentally just a two-party system. It's just, you know, we're stuck with a two-party system. No way around that. And so what that does is it opens that up substantially. I think it's a great thing, and congratulations to the citizens of Burlington, Vermont. Now, the Dubai ports deal thing is still cooking along, and we will see how this thing shakes out. The Forbes, the magazine Forbes, is reporting in an article, Bye-Bye Dubai, by David Andelman and Jessica Holzer, that this new entity, so they're asking questions about this. The new entity is supposed to have an American board and American managers. This is the new entity that's going to take over the American ports. But the ownership was still questionable. If DP World is in fact merely planning to put its U.S. assets under a U.S.-managed subsidiary with oversights from a U.S. staff board, it would be following a long line of foreign suppliers of defense technology in the U.S. Apparently, there's a lot of foreign companies that are selling, you know, that are part of the military-industrial complex that do just this. They basically hire front people, Americans, to run a U.S.-managed subsidiary. Essentially, and Clyde Prestowitz of the Economic Strategy Group in Washington says it looks like that's what they're planning on doing. Other folks suggest that they are probably going to either subcontract it or sell it, those portions of it, to Halliburton or other companies. But Halliburton is one that seems to be named the most often. But what this really brings up, and in this article in Forbes, they just said it very well. Noriel Robini of Robini Global Economics Monitor says, the U.S. needs roughly $900 billion in investment this year to fund its gaping current account deficit. Now, the current account deficit is the amount more, it's basically the trade deficit. It is the amount of money, the net amount of money left over from the amount of stuff that we buy versus the amount of stuff we sell to the rest of the world. So we bought this year we're in the process of, we're heading toward buying something close to $900 billion worth of stuff, more from the rest of the world than we sold to the rest of the world. And so the rest of the world sitting around, you know, with $900 billion in U.S. dollars going, what will we do with these dollars? And the U.S. doesn't make blue jeans anymore. Levi Strauss closed the last blue jean factory a year or two. I guess we won't buy those. We don't make TVs anymore. The last TV factory closed a few years ago. We don't make computers anymore. Dell says they assemble them in Texas, but, you know, there's really no parts in there that are made in the United States. What are they going to buy from America? Yeah, there's really not that much. I mean, you know, so they come over and they say, well, we'll take this port. We'll take this building. We'll take this company. We'll buy, you know, this publisher. We'll buy this auto company. We'll buy Chrysler. We'll buy it, on and on it goes. And as Robini notes, as Forbes magazine notes, investors are increasingly interested in owning real assets rather than stocks and bonds. And therefore, says Robini, we do not have the luxury to snub the world. This is this absolute disaster that George Bush has put us into. In fact, that's the That's the trade deficit. Now, at the same time, we have a national debt of $9 trillion. Well, it's a little over $8 trillion right now, but Jon Snow is saying, let's raise it to $9 trillion. Bob in Boston wrote in, he says, a dollar bill is 43 one-thousandths of an inch in thickness. So if you stacked $9 trillion bills, which is what Jon Snow says we should raise the debt ceiling to, and we may, you know, in the very near future, because right now the Bush administration is borrowing from the pension funds, federal pension funds, to keep the government running. If you put a stack of $9 trillion $1 bills, say, in your front yard, it would stick. It would go up 610,795 miles. That's 2.5 times, 2.56 to be precise, 2.5 times the distance from here to the moon. Pretty amazing. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. If you'd like to weigh in on the issues of the day, it's Friday. We can cover pretty much anything you want, plus I got a stack of news here for you. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hart.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed, proud to be a union man. 21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. In the democracy zone, you are. Bush's approval is sinking faster than a, I can't come up with a metaphor for this one. I tell you, he's down to 37%. I wonder what's going to happen if he hits 33%. I mean, there is that historic thing of when among animals, even when there's a predator around, among animals, when you hit that particular crash point, where more than two-thirds of the animals want to go in a particular direction, everyone pretty much goes that direction. This was the big difference, frankly, between what happened with Nixon and what happened with Bill Clinton in terms of the impeachment, was that about two-thirds of Americans said, Nixon's no good. And about two-thirds of Americans said, hey, Bill Clinton's just fine. And as we've talked before, there's a biological issue here. There's a biological imperative involved in this thing. So anyhow, it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays. What's happening, though, is obviously the Republicans are running as fast as they can away from George W. Bush and trying to put as much distance as they can between themselves and him, and they will continue to do so right through the end of the year, other than, you know, when he can raise some money for them. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Norm in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Norm, what's on your mind today?
Is this Tom?
It is. I am.
Okay. Two things. You have made repeated references to the debt. National debt is around $8 or $9 trillion. Now, Pete Peterson, who used to be the Commerce Secretary in the Nixon administration, wrote a book about 2 years ago called "Running on Empty." The figures that he quotes have been confirmed. I saw him on C-SPAN by the Comptroller of the Currency about 6 months ago. And the real debt is not $8 or $9 trillion. It's more like $48 trillion because the government operates on a cash accounting system instead of an accrual system like business operates on. They don't recognize a liability until it actually comes up. So they're not considering unfunded liabilities, government pensions, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Norm.
Number two.
And, well, let's just explain that for our listeners, because that's really an important point. When a business does their books, they have to put on their, and they incur an obligation, for example. They say I own a business and I bought a machine and, you know, I'm going to have to pay for that machine over a couple of years. I have to put that obligation on my books as a debt.
On a balance sheet.
That's right, on the balance sheet. And over time, as I'm paying down the machine and I'm accumulating equity or I'm accumulating depreciation, I also, that goes under the balance sheet, the depreciation goes under the P&L, and you have to keep track of all that stuff. The government, for purposes of reporting the debt, is only measuring actual cash in, actual cash out, not long-term obligations.
Right.
And no business could do that without going to jail. I mean, if you tried to do that as a guy running a business, the IRS would come lock you up. And in fact, the government itself doesn't do that. The government also does accrual accounting. They do it internally. And, you know, Jon Snow is doing this stuff. And you're right. On an accrual basis, our government is vastly more in debt than $8 trillion.
A valid comparison is that's four times GDP.
Yeah.
Okay,
wait a minute. In a way, that's not a valid comparison because GDP is just 1 year. That's your snapshot in the moment.
GDP, it gives the listener a comparison to know how big a number that is.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you're right.
Point number two, there's a book, 1205, published by John Ralston Saul called The Collapse of Globalism. Very, very scholarly historical work that shows how this sort of globalization has been around before and how it has failed before and why.
And John Ralston Saul has been writing about this for 20 years, by the way.
Well, not about that.
He's been predicting disasters
and a few other things, but he hasn't been writing about globalization.
No, he's been predicting disasters and saying that gold was going to go to $1,000 and that the Great Depression is coming and that sort of thing. And
you've been talking about gold going up as well.
I know. I'm not.
I'm not trying to put him down.
I'm not trying to put him down. Okay. I think he's been accurately diagnosing our problems, and these guys have been holding our economy together with smoke and mirrors and spit and bubble gum.
Right. Just trying to give you a little ammunition to make your points better. I love your show, and I listen to you regularly.
Well, thank you, Norm. Thanks for listening to us on Talk 1090 there in Seattle. Alan in Peoria, Arizona?
That's correct.
Hey, Alan, we have just 1 minute before we've got to take a break. What's on your mind?
I was wondering, I'm looking at an article in the New York Times, and they're talking about unemployment, and they're saying that jobs picked up, but the unemployment rate picked up.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, because the economy is growing, because there are more people in the United States, because, the birth rate, we still have a net, we're adding people, about 150,000 people a month to the workforce in the United States. The number of people coming into the workplace is growing. The number of jobs is growing. But if we don't add 150,000 jobs every month, then unemployment will also go up.
So it's all a lie.
Well, we're adding jobs at a slower rate than we're adding people. That's the bottom line. Yeah. And therefore, unemployment is going up. Although they're trying to spin it. They're saying, oh, gee, the economy is looking so good that these people who were the long-term unemployed, who we weren't counting, have decided to go looking for jobs. So now we have to count them because they're back in the job market.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, but that's nonsense. I mean, that's what they're saying in the press releases, but it's nonsense. So you look at the numbers, what's happening is that this economy, this recovery is running at about 0.9% annual growth. And the last three recoveries have run between 2.5% and 3.5% annual growth. And this is not a recovery. We are hanging on by our fingernails as a result of Reaganomics reinvented as Bushonomics. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And Ron was a whiz bang on the dial. Almost as big as Jesus. They had a catchy name, and they glued it on the baseball park downtown.
Oh, indeed they did.
And Ron. And Ron took my money. We lost it all, they say. With questionable accounting, I gutted my 401k.
Yes, remember those good old days, good old Enron. They still own my power company. I mean, this is incredible. Where I live, when I write a check to pay my electric bill, the money's going to Enron. And you know what they did here in Portland? They charged us hundreds of millions of dollars over a period of a number of years that they said was taxes that they were collecting. They never paid the taxes, and they put the money in their pockets. And they're still doing it. It's incredible. That's incredible. But, I didn't mean to start off on an Enron rant. In fact, actually, really, it's interesting what's going on with the Republicans.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yeah, the Republicans are just up to some really strange stuff.
It's time to play Find the Leader of the Democrat Party.
Now, you notice this is the new ad. This just went out this morning from the RNC to all the talk show hosts all across the country and everybody, right? And this you'll notice they don't call it the Democratic Party, which is its real name, because Democratic, according to polling done by, who knows, Frank Luntz or whatever, Democratic sounds too, well, Democratic. So they call it the Democrat Party, which there is no such thing. And I am waiting for one of the times when one of these RNC bozos is on, you know, Matthews or something, and says, well, the Democrat Party. And I am waiting for Chris Matthews to demonstrate that he is actually was once a Democrat and say, excuse me, there is no such thing as the Democrat Party. It's the Democratic Party. And anyhow, here's the Republicans continuing with this.
Today's contestant, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. Okay, who is the leader of the Democrat Party?
All we ask is that this we not turn into a country like Iran, where the president of Iran can do anything they want at any time.
Now, see, they're taking quotes out of context. That's actually, that's prescient. That was Howard Dean saying, we don't want Iraq turning into Iran. And, in fact, now the Iraqi Constitution allows for a Supreme Court with Islamic law, although they haven't, you know, they still haven't formed a government yet, so we have a bit of a problem. Anyhow, it continues.
Democratic chairman does not speak for me, an elected United States senator. No party official speaks for me anytime, any place, under any circumstances.
There you go. Joe Biden saying, well, you know, Hardin doesn't speak for me. Okay, so, you know.
Because when you look at the way the House of Representatives has been run, it has been run like a plantation, and you know what I'm talking about.
If you are looking for someone that is going to be a friend of the disabled, it's not going to be Judge Alito.
Our plan is to stop him from
Yeah, and on it goes. And frankly, it's kind of funny. I mean, they it's not kind of funny. It's kind of odd that they would use sound clips that I think most Americans listening to this Republican attack ad are going to say, you know, I kind of like what those Democrats are saying. Those members of the Democratic Party. I kind of like that. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartmann.com. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey. Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a weak attack ad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's an attempt. You know, maybe they put some interns on it.
Right. Well, while we're talking about that, I'm looking here. I emailed you yesterday this attack fundraising letter by the John O'Neill, the Swift Boat guy.
Yeah.
Did you get that?
I did. And I got one in email myself.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if I got yours. I mean, but in any case, yes, I have it. You're talking about attacking Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. And all the same old nonsense. They're going to try to Swift Boat him. But what I wanted to mention was, when you go to this Newsmax site, I never really go to these con sites, but it's like a bizarro world, like Colbert Report. You know, you go in there, and the ads are real telling of the type of people that go there. You see, like, Viagra ad, then it goes right up to Lazy Man, Personal Profit Center, earned billions in 6 hours. Then there's one, you know, Everlasting Eternal Love Through God. All these ads.
Yeah, and a lot of them for how to pump up your muscles.
Money and God.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You don't see it on liberal sites.
No, you don't. It's really interesting. I agree with you. And here's the other. And Tom, thank you very much for calling in and pointing that out. Here's the other thing here over on the right wing sites. This is from WorldNet Daily, which is one of the two big right wing sites, are WorldNet Daily and Newsmax. And Joseph Farah, lame duck George W. Bush obviously has no care for how his party performs in the 2008 presidential election. See, this is. The Republicans are trying to put as much distance as they can between themselves and Bush. And Bush wants them to. This is the thing that most people don't get. Bush has screwed up. Okay, you know, we'll just have to acknowledge that. And frankly, I think Karl Rove has internally. They obviously, with Iraq, big time blew it. With the economy, they blew it. They thought Reaganomics might actually work. They were taken, I suspect that they were as taken in by Reagan and Reaganomics as were most Americans. They actually believed that there was some truth to it, and there isn't, and there wasn't. But in any case, so you've got these Republicans now trying to put some space between themselves and the White House. And Bob Novak, really just laying it out. He says, and by the way, you know, it used to be that when any Democrats criticized Bush, then the Republicans would go, ah, they hate the president. They must hate America. So here's Bob Novak criticizing Bush. He says, Republican congressmen are tired of being bullied and ignored by a heavy-handed executive, and they're playing hardball with their president. Given, now here's the key sentence, Bob Novak's latest column. Given his unpopularity, many of them find it useful to distance themselves from Bush anyway. So here you go. I mean, this is the Republicans in Congress, even though ideologically they're right there with Bush. Yes, let's have a fascist state. Yes, let's have incredible debt. Yes, let's wipe out the middle class. Yes, let's destroy the environment, hand it over to private corporations, and on and on and on. But, you know, that doesn't sell well back home. Larry, and is it LeConnor, Washington?
Yeah.
Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, the theory that I put a lot of stock in is the reason for going into Iraq was because Saddam was trading his oil for food in euros.
I thought he was trading oil for food in dollars.
No, he was trading. He was trading.
He was threatening to create a euro-based bourse,
yes,
or trading.
Okay, force. The bourse is scheduled for the 20th of March, and so
in Iran.
In Iran, right? So, I was wondering. I mean, I put a lot of stock into that one. It seems like it would explain a lot of the, you know, belligerence and so forth of the neocons. But
not just the neocons. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the United States is in a pretty bad hole right now, and the only reason, one of the main reasons why the rest of the world continues to loan us money and continues to buy things with dollars is because they can convert those dollars into oil. And if oil starts trading in euros instead of dollars, the United States, all of us, Republican, Democratic, all of us are going to be in big trouble.
Well, that's correct. So, and to avoid that, I mean, it ties in a lot of things for me anyway. I'm just watching this 20th coming, right? The 20th of March coming. So, you know, you would assume that people with loads of dough who invest their money around can move it anywhere they want to, thanks to NAFTA and all that kind of stuff. You would think there would be an exodus in our mutual funds and things like that.
There is. Yeah, I reported on this program 2 days ago. There was an article about it in the Wall Street Journal, how mutual funds in the United States that invest in foreign stocks, in non-U.S. stocks, have doubled in volume in this last year, in the last three months, whereas U.S. stock-based mutual funds are below 100%. That is, they are declining.
Yeah.
So what's happening is U.S. investors are moving their money out of the United States right now, and they're doing it rather aggressively. I mean, you know, overseas investment doubling inside the United States at the same time that the United States is desperately in need of dollars, you know, because we're borrowing $2 billion a day just to keep the government afloat, plus we're selling to the world somewhere between $2 and $3 billion, or we're buying from the world, rather, between $2 and $3 billion a day worth of stuff that we have no means to pay for, other than to give them, here, you can have this port, here, you can have this airport.
Yeah. No, I understand all this. So, but the argument you're making right here is that the oil bourse is going on the 20th. It is going to happen.
Well, do you know that for a fact?
I can't find no information saying that it's not going to happen.
Well, see, I haven't seen a word about that
thing
in the media in about 4 weeks. It's just like, you know, in the end of last year, there was a lot of talk about it. The Iranians were talking about it. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was talking about it. I mean, everybody, and then the last 2 months or so, it's just been absolute silence. And I'm just wondering if somebody said to the Iranians, and perhaps it was Vlad Putin, said to the Iranians, hey, you know, you really don't want to push this one.
Yeah, well, maybe.
You know, we really just don't want World War III. Just don't push this one.
For sure, but that's the 20th, and it's coming anyway. I just wanted, you know.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out on the 20th, won't we?
Okay, good talk to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Larry. This is a really interesting. The oil bourse that Larry was talking about, if you're not familiar with this, is oil is bought and sold on these trading floors, and there's the two primary ones. My understanding of it is that there are two primary ones, one in Europe, one in the United States, and they both are denominated in dollars. And so all the oil around the world is bought and sold in dollars, oil futures. And the Iranians are saying, and they're sitting on the fourth largest supply of oil in the world, they're saying that they're going to create, not only are they going to start selling their oil in euros rather than dollars, but they're going to create a trading floor where other countries can sell their oil in euros rather than dollars. And they even had, Chavez down in Venezuela was saying that he might participate in that. Now Venezuela is one of the largest suppliers of oil to the United States. Iran's oil, you know, substantial supplier of oil to the United States and certainly the rest of the world, particularly to China and Russia. And if all this flips to euros, it could be a big problem. Big problem. So we'll see what happens when the 20th comes. 45 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts unto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The idea of creating a new trading platform in Iran, this is from the Asia Times, an interesting op-ed there. A new trading platform in Iran to trade oil and to create a new crude oil benchmark apparently originated with the former director of the London International Petroleum Exchange, Chris Cook. And he talks about this. The point of this article is that if there is an oil bourse, it won't destroy the U.S. dollar. William Engold writes this thing. Sue in our chat room shared it with me. It's on AsiaTimes.com. Why Iran's oil bourse can't break the buck. I'm going to have to analyze this a little more carefully. I'm skeptical. But we'll get back into that a little later. And we have, a week or so, 2 weeks, 10 days or so before the 21st comes. So we'll make a little time to figure it out. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Tom, I wanted to bring forward in regards to Iran, when Senator Hillary Clinton, I think this was roughly a week ago, I don't remember who she was talking to, the audience, but she had said basically, in regards to Iran, that all options are on the table, that we will not allow them to produce nuclear weapons. Now, that is okay with me. I don't want them to produce nuclear weapons. But my question is, based on what I understand from the IAEA, they're not in violation of the non-proliferation agreement.
No, they're not.
You're allowed to use it for nuclear energy.
Well, yes and no. It's kind of a, and here's where the conservative argument actually has some ring of coherence to it. The non-proliferation treaty essentially says that you can enrich uranium all you want. You can even enrich it to the point where it's weapons grade. What you can't do is then begin combining it into the form of weapons. And so if they go all the way up to that step where they're now not years away from making a weapon, but months away from making a weapon, they can do all that under the treaty. At least that's my understanding of the treaty.
Right.
And it's only when they step over that line that they're in violation of the treaty.
Right.
And that's what people are concerned about. What they're saying is that the treaty really wasn't designed to deal with this kind of thing. But on the other hand, I mean, you've got like India that never signed the treaty. You know, they developed their nuclear weapons program in complete defiance of the international community. But you're absolutely right, though, that Iran is not in violation of the treaty. And
right,
even if they were to start enriching uranium to the point of weapons-grade material, they wouldn't be.
Right. Because the question I had is, as far as I knew, is Pakistan has nuclear weapons. I don't know whether or not they signed the treaty. But as far as I knew, they currently are either producing or in the process of getting nuclear weapons. And they're run by a dictator. So I'm trying to understand is that we've got North Korea, who we know already has nuclear weapons, who are increasing the amount that they have. Why are we not so concerned? I just don't see Democrats or Republicans talking enough about North Korea or other countries who are undemocratic, who have, you know, possession of nuclear weapons, and we're just focusing on Iran. I'm just trying to understand. This is really puzzling to me.
Well, it's the bully strategy. I mean, you have to understand the mentality of a bully. A bully doesn't pick on people who they know will fight back or will have the capability of fighting back. And, you know, George Bush has demonstrated. Saddam Hussein did not have the ability to fight back. His army had been largely wiped out by, first of all, by 10 years of war with Iran that cost him, you know, a million young soldiers. And then the 1991 war, you know, the Gulf War, that George W. Bush, you know, kicked him out of Kuwait. And then on top of that, we had all these years and years and years of sanctions and no-fly zone. We bombed his Air Force into smithereens. He had no Navy. We bombed his army. We bombed his missile sites. His people were dying at the rate of 500,000 a year as a consequence of the fact that we said that chlorine was something that could be used to make gas, poison gas, and therefore we wouldn't sell him chlorine, so they couldn't purify the water supplies in Iraq. And so you had 500,000, mostly kids, dying of diarrheal diseases every year. I mean, a country that had been like the Paris of the Middle East, I mean, it had been incredibly affluent, Iraq was, before 1991. had became basically was devastated back to third world status by the policies, you know, and you could argue that this started with Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, although, you know, there are those who would say that it was April Gillespie who, you know, our Assistant Secretary of State, who told him that he could do it. But and that was a setup that George Bush Sr. wanted, because he wanted to have a war with this guy. But in any case, however you slice and dice it, the bottom line is that picking on Saddam Hussein and taking out Iraq was something that Bush knew he could do. It would be easy. Picking on Kim Jong-il in North Korea and trying to take him out, that's going to be tough. He's got a million-man army that has not engaged in combat since 1952. And they're strong, they're ready, and they're well-armed. Plus, he has nuclear weapons. Picking on the Iranians, that's going to be tough. They've got an army that's substantial. I don't know how many people in it. And they don't have nuclear weapons, but they have a massive, conventional armaments. Plus, they have treaties with China and Russia. So,
Tom, do you think is this a message we're sending out to countries saying, you know, if you don't have nuclear weapons, you know, we can come after you? I mean, do you think this is a message we're sending out?
Of course. This is the consequence of our invading Iraq. Bush came out and he said, okay, there's three countries out there that are evil and ultimately are going to have to answer to us: Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. So North Korea goes out and they build an atomic bomb right away. And so Bush doesn't do anything about them. Iraq says, okay, we're disarming. You can send over your inspectors. We'll give you can look anywhere you want. We got nothing. We got no weapons of mass destruction, no nuclear program. The United Nations, IAEA, goes over there. They look around and say, we can't find anything. So Bush says, okay, we're going after him, right? And Iran is looking at this going, interesting. Got a nuke, they don't invade. No nukes, they do invade. What should we do? And, yeah, so I think that and Patricia, thank you for the call. The Iranian program was under voluntary seal, as was the North Korean program. Throughout most of the Clinton administration, I mean, these were deals that were cut by and large during the Clinton administration, and they were essentially in a box. They were frozen. They were only using them to produce electricity, and that was it. And then Bush came along and started all his bellicosity, making all these noises and strutting and preening, and these countries said, whoa, you know, this guy's a threat. We need to develop a defensive position. And so there you go. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
At Borders.
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Time for an environmental alert. Yes, indeed. A dark cloud over disclosure, write Jim Jeffords and Julie Fox Gorte in today's New York Times. Now, Jim Jeffords, you've probably heard of. He's the United States Senator from Vermont who was a Republican and became an independent because he was so horrified by Bush's policies, particularly his education policies. Julie Fox Gorte, you've probably not heard of. She is with the Calvert Group. In fact, her title is Vice President of the chief social investment strategist for the Calvert Group. The Calvert Group is an investment group. You know, if you want to, it's like they've got a bunch of mutual funds and things, you know. And if you want to invest money, you can buy one of their mutual funds. And so anyhow, here's the question that they pose in today's New York Times. How would you like to have lawfully sold your Tyco stock months before the corporate scandal hit the front pages? Now, consider that. I mean, Tyco was flying high. Man, they were doing good. And people who had invested in Tyco were making piles of money. And the stock was way up there. And then the fact that Kozlowski and all the whole scandal around Tyco, that the criminal activities were going on in the boardroom, all that came out, hit the pages of the newspapers, and Tyco's stock went in the toilet. Just tanked totally. And a lot of people lost their pensions, lost their retirements, lost their savings, lost a lot. But Calvert Group didn't. Calvert Group sold just before Tyco's tanked. Why? Well, as Jim Jeffords and Julie Fox Gorte write, you know, how would you like to have lawfully sold your Tyco stock? That's without inside information? That's precisely what the Calvert Group did when a disturbing trend in Tyco's annual toxic emission disclosures led to questions about how well Tyco was managing the rest of its operations. In other words, they're looking at Tyco's various companies. One of them's right here in Portland. They're looking at these various companies that Tyco runs, and they have to report every year the accidental and intentional emissions of toxic materials, chemicals, poisons, you know, carcinogens, everything from PCBs, lead, and mercury on down, you know, 650 different chemicals. That if they release them, they have to tell people about it. And the folks at the Calvert Group saw this increase in the releases, and they thought, you know, a well-run company wouldn't be doing this. Tyco must not be a well-run company. Let's sell the stock. And they did. And thus, when the whole world knew that Tyco wasn't a well-run company, they didn't get burned. Now, the way the Calvert Group was able to do that was because they saw this trend in Tyco's annual toxic emission disclosure. Now, write Jim Jeffords and Julie Fox Gorte, now President Bush and the Environmental Protection Agency want to weaken the largely successful toxic release inventory program, which requires companies to tell the public how they dispose of nearly 650 chemicals, which may harm human health and the environment. This is a disclosure that is available, by the way, to everybody, journalists, policymakers, investors, parents. You want to learn what's going on with the company down the street from you? Are they dumping toxins into the ground, into the air, into the water? You can just look it up. This program was put together back in 1986 after the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India, went down and killed thousands of people in the process. And lawmakers here in the United States looked around and said, you know, Union Carbide is operating plants in the United States as well, and it's not just Union Carbide. There are a lot of plants in this country where if there was a release of gas, thousands of people might die. So let's require companies to tell us what they're doing. And they identified 650 chemicals that they said, you know, these 650 chemicals, these are dangerous things. These are dangerous chemicals. And if these chemicals get into the air or into the water or whatever, we got a problem. And some of them are really hyper dangerous. PCBs, lead, and mercury, for example. I mean, just micrograms, a millionth of a gram. Not milligrams, not a thousandth of a gram. And a gram is like, you know, depending on the element, of course, you know, half a teaspoonful, more or less. And a millionth of that. Units, that you measure mercury in the body in micrograms. Little tiny amounts accumulating in people's bodies. So they said, if you release over 50 pounds of mercury or lead or PCBs into the air, you have to disclose it. If you release any of these 650 chemicals, more than a few hundred pounds a year, you have to disclose it. So now the Bush administration wants to say, no. Well, I'll just quote the first would relax the current annual reporting requirement and let companies make reports every other year instead of every year, so they get to do it every other year. The second would allow polluters to release 10 times more toxic chemicals, up to 5,000 pounds annually, without disclosing the volume released or where the pollutants went. The Bushies, yeah, we don't care if you get sick and die. Hey, our buddies are making more profits. And the third would permit companies to conceal releases of up to 500 pounds annually of particularly dangerous toxic materials like PCBs, lead, and mercury, which can accumulate in people's bodies. All three changes effectively increase the amount of pollution the companies can emit without telling anyone. And then, and this is a really interesting take, here we have an op-ed in today's New York Times by a United States senator and by the vice president of an investment company, saying that this so-called pro-business program that the Bushies are putting forward, right? I mean, the Bushies are saying, and the EPA are saying, well, we want to do this because it'll be good for business. And here is the vice president of one of America's largest investment groups, the Calvert Group, and a U.S. senator who's no dummy himself, saying, no, it won't be good for business. It won't be, in particular, good for investors. It may be good for a few small polluters, but making America a more toxic place, that's not good for business. And investors want to know. They want to know, are these companies well-run? Are they destroying the environment? Are they going to have bad public relations problems? Are they producing so much toxic material in their local environment that, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 6 months, whatever, down the road, they're going to have millions of dollars in liabilities to clean this stuff up? We as investors would like to know this. We think this is important stuff, says the Calvert Group, and says Senator Jim Jeffords. In fact, it just they say it very, very, very clearly. Investors should be particularly concerned about the effects of the agency's proposal. Sound investment requires sound information. We have long honored the disinfectant power of sunshine in our securities laws, dating back to the reforms after the stock market crash of 1929, as well as the reforms that followed the more recent governance scandals. So the Bush administration and the EPA want to gut the toxic release inventory program. And now we have 12 state attorney generals who have joined in opposition to this thing. They're getting together. They point out, for example, after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the first responders into the area, how did they know what they were walking into? If you're asking people to walk into a natural disaster or even a man-made disaster, I mean, this was not the case in New York City, but it could have been, you know, if it was in one of the outlying areas where there might be, particularly in New Jersey area or wherever, where there's chemical factories, how do you know what you're walking into? Well, the toxics release disclosure, the toxic release inventory, excuse me, will tell you. And, in fact, they point out first responders and citizens after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita used toxic release inventory data to identify factories and industrial sites where toxic chemical releases would have been possible. A Texas community used such data to inform the public when companies were polluting the rich shrimp and oyster breeding grounds in the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, many companies, in fact, they go on to say many companies intend to continue annual reporting regardless of the EPA's rule changes. DuPont, for example, says his company will probably continue to collect and release information annually, saying it's just a good business practice to track your hazardous materials. Plus, DuPont says they're internally committed to being transparent about their environmental performance. So why would the Bush administration want to weaken this fundamental law that says, here's what you can know about what's going on in your community? Could it have something to do with George W. Bush having done essentially the same thing in Texas and creating a toxic wasteland in much of Texas as a consequence of making most of the environmental rules in Texas while he was governor that were solid rules and regulations into voluntary programs? And then, gee, surprisingly, a lot of these corporations just say, no, we don't. You know, it's voluntary. We just decided we're not going to go along with it. We're not going to do that. We're not interested. That's the direction they want to move this thing because they don't believe in government. We're back to where we started yesterday. We're back to Ronald Reagan. You know, just his basic, Reagan's basic rant that the government is this terrible, scary thing. I'm sorry, government is us protecting us. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Interior Secretary Gail Norton may be the latest victim of the Abramoff scandal, although it's really interesting how this is being spun. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Gail Norton, well, here's how CNN is playing it, okay? Just straight up. Interior Secretary Gail Norton is resigning after 5 years in President Bush's cabinet, the Associated Press has learned. Norton, a former Colorado attorney general who guided the Bush administration's initiative to open Western government lands to more oil and gas drilling. Now, as I'm reading this news story to you, just listen and notice if you hear the phrase Jack Abramoff anywhere. Norton, a former Colorado attorney general who guided the Bush administration's initiative to open Western government lands to more oil and gas drilling, planned to announce her decision Friday, a senior government official and another source familiar with her decision, told the AP. And it goes on for five more paragraphs. Not once does it mention the fact that she took $50,000 from Jack Abramoff, and that's kind of coming out, you know? Ellen Ratner is with us on Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's your take on this Gail Norton thing? Is she leaving because of the $50,000 she took from Jack Abramoff, or is she just tired?
Well, you know, the official reason, of course, is that she's going to spend time with her family or whatever. Not that I don't think she's married, in Colorado. But unofficially, you just don't pick up and kind of leave the administration. Also, it's interesting, Trent Duffy is also leaving. He's one of the assistant press secretary, nice guy, though. And we don't really know why he's leaving. So two major announcements today.
Interesting. Yeah, well,
we don't know what that's about. You know, it'll take a little while for people to talk and for it to leak.
Something's muffling your voice there, Ellen.
Something's muffling my voice. I'm on Greg's cell phone. I'm probably not used to it. How does that sound?
That's fine. Yeah, maybe you had your finger over the little microphone.
Also,
so what's happening in Washington?
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on with this ports deal. And as you know, the Republicans are saying, oh, this is a great deal. It's done. Well, there are actually some Republicans who realize that this is a bigger issue with their constituents, and they are going to actually have hearings because they want to change the entire way the U.S. does business on security, what they consider secure resources, and also in terms of trade issues. All kinds of deals that
are
done.
And they want to get out ahead of the Democrats on this.
And they clearly want to get a hold, because, in fact, there was a breakfast this morning that I was at, Sherrod Brown was there. In fact, he was speaking at it. It was just sort of liberal journalists sponsored by the American Prospect to rival the Sperling breakfast that has happened for years by the Christian Science Monitor. In any case, he was essentially putting out his platform and saying that there are liberal Democrats who are running for Congress and for the Senate, and they're going to go on the issue of security. And the Republicans realize this, and they realize that just because this deal went through, Americans are very, very suspect. So there are some people that are really going to push this. And the White House, and actually Bush today, said in his meeting with the Journal and National Association newspapers, said that he was concerned about the message, the reaction to the Dubai ports deal was sending to America's allies in the Middle East.
Well,
so they know.
Excuse me, go ahead.
They know that they got troubles.
Yeah, well, there's a bigger problem, too, here, and that is that because of the insane trade policies that we've been pursuing, Reagan began this stuff, but Bill Clinton really kicked it into hyperdrive by signing NAFTA and GATT and creating the World Trade Organization, that because of these insane international trade policies, we now have to we have to find some way to sell something to the tune of $900 billion a year to the rest of the world. And we're not making much anymore that the rest of the world wants to buy. So they're buying our natural resources. They're buying our mines. They're taking our oil. Oddly enough, you know, we want to open the oil up in Alaska. Where's it going to go? To Japan? They're buying our ports and they're buying our other. I mean, how are we going to continue selling off America to these companies and continuing this trade policy that allows Walmart to survive if we start saying to these companies, to these other countries, sorry, there's some of our stuff you can't buy? I mean,
well,
that's
you know,
thing
it's
that
interesting.
A lot of Republicans are concerned about.
The Bush administration is pushing their economic numbers today, saying that in fact they have that real income is average daily wage is up. I think it's 5% or something, but real income is essentially down 2%, as I understand it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so they're pushing this.
This
but
is
it's
the,
just not true.
This is the slowest recovery since the Great Depression, the slowest recovery from a recession.
And they're pushing all their job creation. But
yeah.
In fact, they've created a whole lot less than Bill Clinton did in the same amount of time.
Right. Plus, they're saying that their tax cuts are increasing Treasury revenues when the Center for Policy Studies just did a really good analysis of this last week. And, in fact, their tax cuts have caused us to bring in $350 billion so far, less than we would have had without the tax cuts. So, you know, go figure. It just ain't working. I mean, you know, people are not drinking their Kool-Aid. So
no, they're not drinking the Kool-Aid, and I think the Democrats are very aware of it. Let's just hope they don't screw it up without and you know, change their message every 2 minutes like Kerry did.
Yeah. Yes. Well said, Ellen. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you so much for being with us, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Yeah, let's hope the Democrats can keep this thing on message and on point and you know, be about it. Because there is such an opportunity here, and we so need to take this country back. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Jim in Everett, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm just curious. You were talking about the whole issue of oil being traded in euros and what that would mean.
Right.
What's going on with the rest of industrial commodities?
Like steel, you mean?
Yeah. Steel, aluminum, tin, zinc.
I don't know that any of those markets are anywhere near as large as the market for oil, and therefore that they have such centralized trading that it can affect a currency.
Right, but we're paying $1.05 a pound for low-carbon steel in the U.S., and everybody else in the world is paying something under 35 cents a pound U.S.
Why is that?
I don't know. I just know that it is.
So we're paying $1.05 for American-made steel?
Well, there is no American-made steel in this class. I mean, one of the big lies is you go to the U.S. Steel and they talk about all the steel they made at the Shady Side plant in Pittsburgh.
Hmm.
The Shady Side plant in Pittsburgh was burned down by U.S. Steel back in the late 70s.
Hmm. So the low-carbon steel, I thought... I thought low-carbon steel is cheap steel, isn't it? I thought high-carbon steel was the really fancy stuff.
Well,
the higher the carbon, the harder the steel.
All structural steel is low-carbon steel.
Right, okay, yeah.
Okay.
And whereas the stuff for tool and die work is high-carbon steel.
Correct.
Yeah, all right. So we are no longer making the structural steel in the United States?
No, we're making some of the tool steels and some of the stainless steels and some of the...
Jim? Jim has vanished. Oh, he's still there?
I was here.
Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry, I couldn't hear you there for a minute. You were saying.
Oh, the only place we seem to be getting a bargain on international is for some of the high-temperature materials like rhenium and zirconium.
Yeah. That's absolutely weird, you know, because you would think that, for example, a big buyer of steel like General Motors or a construction company, Bechtel, for example, that they would, if the world price on steel is 35 cents a pound, they'd go out and buy it for 35 cents a pound. Why would we pay? I don't know the answer to that question.
I find it hard to believe that they're paying that price.
Yeah, yeah. Are you in the steel business?
Well, I'm in the design and development business.
Yeah, so you're familiar with the prices.
Yeah.
Interesting. This is an area I don't know that much about. I don't have an answer to your question. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I can go to Canada and I can buy steel cheap. Just don't get, you come across the border with it and you'll get questioned very severely.
But you can bring it across the border, can't you? I mean, there's not.
Paying tariffs.
So there are still tariffs
going on.
Yeah, well, Bush jacked up tariffs on steel a while back, you know, when he needed some political capital in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and whatnot.
Yeah. And then when they, quote-unquote, canceled the tariffs, the prices jumped.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
The party line is it's China bidding up the price, but I see bids from Chinese companies. And for, you know, low-carbon steel, they're talking 6-7 cents a pound when you back out their prices.
Amazing. Well, Jim, if you track it down, let me know. If you can figure it out, let me know, because that's fascinating. I just don't know the answer. I appreciate your call, and thank you for educating me about it. But if you track something down, call us back and let us know. Jay in Arcata, California. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Cool. You were talking about getting Democrats in. I just thought what we need for the 06 elections are some simple slogans that, you know, not complicated changing of positions and so forth. And I forthwith have one to offer.
Okay.
Get the Reds out of Washington.
There you go. That's a good
great bumper sticker.
Yeah. Get the Reds out of Washington. Okay, thank you. Thank you a lot, Jay. Good to hear from you. Greg in Seattle, and thanks for listening on KGOE in Archaea. Greg in Seattle on Talk 1090. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Thank you. I've been trying to figure out why Bush is so aggressive at airport security and he's so lax on seaport security.
It has to do with visibility.
Then it occurred to me that all airports are in suburbs and all seaports are in cities. And Republicans do very well in the suburbs and do very poorly in the cities. I just don't think they think about cities.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's anywhere near that Machiavellian, Greg. I think what's very, you know, what it is that millions of people literally a day go through airports. And so when the Bush administration wanted an opportunity to look like they were being tough on terror and they were taking steps to protect America, here's an opportunity to expose a million people a day or more to you know, muscular, yeah, we're protecting you, at least the image of it. Now, that's the thing that tells me that it's all about image is that they're not inspecting the cargo on those planes.
That tells me why they pay attention to airports.
Right.
It doesn't tell me why they ignore seaports.
They're ignoring the seaports because it costs money, because they really don't believe that international terrorism represents that big a threat. Excuse me, I got something caught in my throat. They don't believe it's that big a threat. They're looking at this. They're saying, you know, 3,000 people died on 9/11. Okay, you know, it seems like it was a big deal. Everybody was shocked. They were mostly shocked, post-traumatic stress disorder, from seeing that video clip run over and over and over again. But the reality is that 3,000 people die every couple of weeks as a result of drunk drivers, you know. I think it's 50,000 people a year was the last number I heard are killed by drunk drivers in the United States. So, I mean, there are some, you know, if you want to identify risks of living in the United States, terrorism is like way, way low down on the bottom of the scale. And so they're just saying, you know, looking at a risk benefit reward basis, they get political benefits from dealing with the risk of somebody getting onto a plane with a gun or a bomb or something, physically walking on, you know, of looking like they're doing security. But there's really not much of a payoff in having actual security. And that's why they don't bother to screen the cargo that goes on airplanes, even though they're screening the people. And the odds of a bomb going on with a person are much lower than the bomb going on with cargo. And there have been planes blown out of the sky by bombs in their cargo pits. So number one, they're not doing that. And number two, port security, same deal. It's going to cost billions of dollars to screen all that stuff. And they're pretty sure that most of it's fairly safe. And if something gets in, you know, what's the big deal? So a few thousand people die or something. You know, I think that's their thinking. I think that they're just looking at it on they're doing the equations. Am I making sense, Greg?
A little.
Yeah, a little. Okay. All right. Well, it's a start. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. I appreciate it. This is when I got it. I was walking through, this is right after 9/11, not right after 9/11, but right after they started making people take their shoes off, which was about a year after 9/11, maybe even a year after that, it might have been right around the elections. And I was going through an airport, and it was when it was like, and I fly a lot, and it was when it used to be sort of voluntary. You know, you go through the airport and you take off your shoes if you thought that they were going to trip off the machine. And so I said, and I was wearing a pair of shoes that I knew had no metal in them. You know, they were like deck shoes. And I said to the person doing the X-ray and whatever, I said, you know, I'm just going to wear my shoes through because they're not going to set off the machine. And she says, okay. And so I walked through, and it didn't set off the machine. And she said, okay, go over there. And I, you know, go over where? Go over there. We're going to wand you down. I said, why? And she said, because you wouldn't take off your shoes. And I said, but I didn't set off the machine. And she says, but if people don't take off their shoes, that's the profile of a terrorist. So we got to wind you down. That's, you know, it's in the rules now. So the choice you have, you know, even if you're not going to set up. So I said, now let me get this. Why do you want my shoes to go through the X-ray machine and all that kind of thing? She says, well, you know, you might have a shoe bomb. And I said, but, you know, plastic explosive, which is what Richard Reed had in his shoes, doesn't show up on an X-ray machine. It looks the same as the sole of a shoe. And she says, well, it doesn't matter. You know, that's what we've got to do. And it's like, it just doesn't make any sense. And at that point, I thought, this is all about appearance, or largely about appearance. Not entirely, and I don't mean to diss the work that the people with the TSA are doing, because I know that there are a lot of, you know, people who are very, very concerned about the security of the United States and working very hard with the TSA and doing, frankly, a very good job. But the fact that the Bush administration will put more money into the TSA last year than they put into the FBI. The TSA's budget was larger than the FBI's. They spent more money frisking Granny than they spent on the FBI. That and the fact that they're not screening the cargo that's going into the belly of the planes, and they're not screening the cargo that's going through our ports, so we're down to like 1%, we're finding out. All of that, what that tells me is that this is, you know, it's all about politics. It's not about security. And that's where this Dubai port deal has the ability. It's why you've got Republicans climbing over each other to be the one on the top of the pile yelling the loudest that they're, in favor of securing our ports. You got Republicans climbing up here because all of a sudden we saw behind the curtain, we saw that great and powerful Wizard of Oz isn't really the Wizard of Oz. By the way, Norm Ornstein is reporting. The PBS NewsHour AEI scholar Norm Ornstein says they got to limit out because they simply aren't American companies that have the know-how, and there simply aren't American companies that have the know-how and breadth to do this, to run these ports. He says, interestingly, and perhaps ironically, what I've heard earlier in the day is that they are looking at those that have the kind of resources, and Halliburton was the name that came up. If it's Halliburton, that means it's going to be Kellogg Brown and Root. If it's Kellogg Brown and Root, that means it's not an American company. So, you know, how are they going to do this? We'll see. We'll see. I got a Berlusconi alert for you. You're going to be boggled by the deal of this 28-year-old Bush staffer and what he's going to be doing for the United States. We'll talk about that and your calls after the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. Just another poor.
Friends, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is incredible. It's a Berlusconi alert. Yes, indeed, another one. You will recall Silvio Berlusconi, the man who bought a small-time crook in Italy and a small businessman who bought a radio station and then a TV station and then another radio station and another TV station, a newspaper and a magazine and another radio station and then a radio network and then a TV network and then another radio network and then another TV network and then another newspaper until he controlled 90% of all the media in Italy, all of the radio and television networks, except for the ones run by the state, their equivalent of public broadcasting, and then he decided to run for political office. And guess what? He won! Well, Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, facing a few problems. The culture secretary's estranged husband faces indictments on bribery and perjury charges. David Mills, Teresa Giles' estranged husband, and Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian Prime Minister, face indictments on bribery and perjury charges after prosecutors in Milan brushed aside attempts by defense lawyers to delay legal proceedings yesterday. This from the Times Online, Times of London. Prosecutors are expected today to ask Fabio Pappalardi, the judge who will preside over a preliminary hearing, to lay charges. Of course, court sources said that Signor Berlusconi and Mr. Mills could be charged next week after the judge has studied the 15,000-page prosecution dossier. The refusal to grant a delay means that Signor Berlusconi faces the embarrassment of corruption charges on the eve of the Italian election on April 9th. So this week, the Italian leader again accused. This is his constant refrain. He again accused left-wing magistrates of inventing stories during an election period. Yes, it's all about Silvio. There you go, our Berlusconi alert, our Silvio Berlusconi alert for the day, I guess. Sometimes there's more than one a week. It's amazing what this guy has been up to. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Andy in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind today?
Who was that, Caruso?
I don't know. It's just an old solo meal. It could have been.
Hey, Tom, you must have been, the guy your producer told me you're only 52 years old, and if that's correct, boy, you've been busy in your life. You haven't wasted much time.
Well, I'm actually 54, but that's close.
Young. Now, I think it was yesterday you were talking about the lowering standards for food labeling.
Yes, sir.
And this a little bit ago I heard you talking about the lowering standards for reporting on pollutant emissions.
That's right.
And the actual emissions themselves.
Yep.
And the way this administration works, can't you just see a little bit down the right line they're going to say, oh, we have to do this to remain competitive with these other countries where we've sent all of our damn jobs?
Yeah, because they don't have to report toxic emission waste.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know,
in fact, that's probably how it's being sold back in Congress.
I mean, that popped into my mind as soon as I heard you talking about that. But,
yeah.
Anyway, I love hearing your
show. Good point,
Andy.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your kind words and thanks for calling. Yeah, that is one of the more good point. That is one of the more common refrains that they lay out. By the way, Dick Cheney has, for reasons inexplicable to anyone on earth, started quoting Waleed Jumblatt. Believe it or not, Waleed Jumblatt, Vice President Dick Cheney, in a speech this week to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, said Waleed Jumblatt, by the way, is just a notorious anti-Semite racist. So Cheney says, over the past 4 years, other free nations have risen in the broader Middle East, blah, 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 blah. One leader in Lebanon said, now he's quoting Jumblatt. He says, when I saw the Iraqi people voting, it was the start of a new Arab world. The Syrian people, the Egyptian people all say that something has changed. The Berlin Wall has fallen. We can see it. Well, Jumblatt also said, and I quote, we are all happy when U.S. soldiers are killed in Iraq week in and week out. The killing of U.S. soldiers in Iraq is legitimate and obligatory. Yes, he said that. He also said, the oil axis is present in most of the U.S. administration, beginning with its president, vice president, and top advisors, including Condoleezza Rice, who is oil-colored, while the axis of Jews is present with Paul Wolfowitz, the leading hawk. I mean, this is Waleed Jumblatt. This is the guy the vice president is quoting. He said, in November 2003, the United States revoked Jumblatt's... I'm not quoting him now. They revoked Jumblatt's diplomatic visa for wishing out loud that Wolfowitz had been killed in a Baghdad rocket attack. So why is Cheney quoting him? Well, it could be that he's the only guy who said anything good about what we're doing in Iraq. And it seems to be working, certainly, to the benefit of the racists, the anti-Semites, and, for that matter, the anti-everything across the Middle East, and the anti-Americans, let's say, at the bottom line. It's just very, very tragic situation. It's 57 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, if you're a vet and you served in Vietnam or in World War II or in Korea or in Iraq or Afghanistan, and you came back and you were having trouble sleeping, you know, remembering what happened or whatever. It's just, you didn't have to engage in war crimes. It just, you know, people see horrible things. Right? Dead bodies, watching people die. It can be a grim thing. So you go to the Veterans Administration and you say, you know, I'm just having a little trouble sleeping here, and maybe you can give me something to help me sleep, you know, because this is the problem. And the doc at the VA, you know, he's got to come up with a diagnosis. And so he says, sounds to me like you have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, of the American Psychiatric Association, the DSM of the APA, which is the official list of all the mental illnesses there are. The word normal, by the way, is not to be found in that book. And so the psychiatrist writes you a prescription and says, you know, here's a little whatever, some, you know, Ambien or Halcyon or whatever the drug du jour is. And, by the way, did you see that story the other day about how all these people with Ambien in their bloodstream because it's the hot new sleeping drug are being caught driving cars at night? They took a sleeping pill and then didn't realize, they forgot they'd taken it because one of its problems is amnesia. In any case, so the VA doc says, okay, here's a prescription for this stuff. You know, take this and it'll help you sleep. And writes down in your records, your VA records, psychiatric problem, post-traumatic stress disorder, insomnia, whatever. And then you go to the airport. You're going to fly to Minneapolis to visit grandma or whatever. You go to the airport, and they won't give you a ticket. Or they really frisk you down before they'll let you get on the plane. Really make you jump through the hoops. And you're going, what happened? Well, the TSA put out a notice looking for contractors to add new databases for screening passengers and airport workers. Passengers and airport workers. First up are the files of the Defense Department and Veterans Administration, which the TSA says it wants scoured for, and I quote, this is from CQ.com, Homeland Security and Intelligence, which the TSA says it wants scoured for, quote, mental defectives. Get this? Remember that guy who was on the airplane back in December with his wife, and all of a sudden he apparently had a panic attack, and he jumped up and ran out of the airplane before, you know, the doors were still open, before they decided to leave, and the couple of air marshals on board ran out, chased him into the jetway and shot him dead. And the guy, you know, he had no weapons. According to the passengers on the plane, he said nothing about bombs or anything. You know, the guy was having a panic attack. Well, the TSA wants to make sure that doesn't happen again. So instead of saying, don't shoot people who are having panic attacks, it's not that uncommon, they want a list of all of the vets who have ever been defined as having a mental problem. And you look at some of these numbers. I mean, according to a 2004 Government Accountability Office study, 15% of the soldiers coming home from intense guerrilla wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are likely to have post-traumatic stress disorder. New England Journal of Medicine in 2004 said 15.6% to 17.1% of returning soldiers from Iraq exhibited signs of anxiety, major depression, or other mental health problems. 53% of the 1 million combat vets from Vietnam are afflicted to one degree or another, according to a four-year, $9 million study published by the VA in 1990. According to, in all, 23% of Iraq veterans treated at VA facilities have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So we're talking millions of people. In the CQ.com, they go on to note, the military services used to put a secret code for mental disorders on veterans' discharge papers until the practice was exposed and banned in 1974. As it turns out, the numbers weren't secret at all to potential employers and others who knew how to decipher them. Maybe now they won't be secret to the airlines or the TSA either. Very strange. Very strange. It's this, in my mind, I'm seeing this as part of this whole larger thing of the police statification of the United States. The loss of privacy, the loss of idiosyncrasy, the death of idiosyncrasy in the United States. You know, if you're wealthy, then it's one thing. If you're poor, it's another thing. If you're wealthy, you're called eccentric. If you're poor, then you're called, you know, a bag lady or whatever. But, you know, the bottom line is that there's a lot of variety among human beings. And we have been working so hard for the last 25 years in this, you know, conservative paradise that we're trying to build here in the United States to turn everybody into a nice white bread conservative who never needs an abortion and never needs information about birth control and never, you know, heaven forbid, any of that stuff, who would never want to look at pornography. Now, these are the kind of the underbelly, right, of society things, some would say. But it goes beyond that. Who doesn't have any learning disabilities in school, who will be just become a perfect little ticky-tacky, you know, the old Phil... No, it wasn't Phil Oakes, but thank you, Alex. The old Pete Seeger song, you know, and they all lived in ticky tacky, and they all look just alike, right? And increasingly, we're seeing this in the United States. It's just spooky. I got to tell you, it just gives me the creeps when I read this. You know, I understand wanting to protect the United States, but there has to be a limit. There has to be a point at which we say Big Brother shouldn't be watching that much. And I would say, in particular for vets, this has got to be it. You know, enough already. Big Brother shouldn't be watching this much. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bob in Puyallup, Washington. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Bob?
Well, I've heard you speak about the corporations and how their term persons. And I wanted to call and talk about the fact that the person is considered a corporation according to IRS Code 7701.
How so?
And by doing that, by creating that artificial person, they are imposing the corporate tax on the public. And according to their own figures, in 2004, the corporations paid 8% of the tax burden, and in 2003 they paid 6%.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word burden, Bob. That's the conservative word to make you think that taxes are not an investment in the future, that they're not, you know, part of the cost of civil society, that instead that they are a burden.
Well,
because they are a burden for millionaires and billionaires.
Yeah,
you know?
they've got a percentage.
Yeah.
But my point is that they are.
Yeah, and corporations were paying about half of all taxes during the Eisenhower administration, and it was down to about a third of all taxes during the Reagan administration, and now it's down around 6-8%.
Well, I think even under the Clinton administration in 99, I got those papers, and I think it was 11%.
Yeah.
When Bush went in 2003, it was down to 6%.
Mm-hmm. So I'm missing your point, though, about how they are considering people as corporations. I mean, clearly
They've created an artificial person, and it says that they created that artificial person for tax purposes.
Right.
Versus a natural person.
Yeah, interesting.
And,
are you sure you're not talking about sub-S corporations, which is where you as an individual can file your small business income along with your personal income?
Well, they are doing that in the sense that when they consider a person as a corporation, as a company, as a partnership, and then they turn around and impose this corporate tax on the people.
Right.
And they use the corporations. But see, what they're doing is they're not giving the people the same tax credits and deductions that they give the corporations.
Yeah, that's for sure, Bob. That's absolutely for sure.
So basically, they give the corporations tax credits, which is dollar for dollar, but they only give the people
deductions. Yeah. Good point. An interesting point. And we are subsidizing. I mean, it's just incredible the level to which we are subsidizing corporate use of the commons here in the United States. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. In just a moment, we're going to be speaking with Jeffrey Kleinman of DVD Talk. But first, Michelle in Tacoma, Washington, wanted to follow up on our discussion earlier about airport security. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I want to say I love your show. My husband and I listen to it every day. Husband is actually an air marshal. And I just wanted to call because, just the feeling that I got was when people explain that story that happened in Florida about the guy who got shot,
right. It's
just become so lackadaisical the way that they explain it, like, oh, the guy was walking down the aisle, he wouldn't do what the air marshals wanted, so they shot him. And it just kind of upsets me sometimes.
Isn't that what happened, though, Michelle?
What?
Isn't that what happened?
No, he did. First of all, his backpack was put onto the front of his chest.
Right.
Which is an oddity. It's a
no, because he was running, holding onto it. He had been sitting in his seat. When you sit down in your seat, you have to take your backpack off and put it on the floor underneath you. So
right.
when he decided he was going to run off the plane, he grabbed his backpack and he's running down the aisle.
Well, exactly. But I'm just explaining to you from the air marshal's point of view what's a red flag.
Sure.
Is people who walk to the airport with them on the front of them,
mm-hmm.
people versus on the back of them. And you know, if you read things, he did say that he had a bomb.
Not according to all of the non- TSA witnesses on the airplane.
Okay.
I mean, they've been interviewed. They were unable to find one single civilian who said that this guy said that he had a bomb. Only the two air marshals said that.
Okay. I just get upset because, you know,
I understand you're defending your husband, and I appreciate that. I wrote several novels about private detectives. I went through the Georgia Police Academy. I have a couple of good friends who are cops. Cops are the most poorly paid people and generally poorly respected people in our society. It's a tragedy. We need to be paying our cops, our firefighters, and our teachers far more and paying them more respect. And air marshals are, you know, police officers in the sky. And no, it's not an easy job. It's a really scary thing to be sitting there, number one, holding a weapon that could kill somebody, and number two, looking for other people who might want to kill you. I mean, that's a really
exactly.
tough job.
I just get the feeling so much with media is that they think like these guys live to wake up every morning and to shoot people.
Well, I don't think that.
I don't think.
Yeah, and I appreciate your comment, Michelle, and thank you. Thank you. And I hope I've satisfied you that I'm not trashing air marshals. What I'm concerned about is an administration that is trying to make everybody constantly afraid and is basically police statificationizing the United States, and it's unnecessary in my opinion, and it's dangerous.
Absolutely. We're very big proponents of all of that, not having our civil liberties taken away. It's just it's such a fine line when you're talking about being in a cylinder tube with 60 people you don't know and there's nowhere to go.
Well, with any law enforcement situation, mm-hmm. with any law enforcement situation, absolutely. I agree with you. Michelle, thank you for the
so
call.
Thank you so much for all your work.
Sure enough, and thanks for sharing your opinion with us. Jeffrey Kleinman of DVD Talk is with us. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Jeffrey's the editor, DVDTalk.com, the website. Jeffrey, I'm curious. The Oscars all seem to have culture or war themes. What's your take on this?
Well, you know, I think that the Oscars tend to reflect what's on the tip of the mind of the collective consciousness in Hollywood, and it was a year for movies that talked about things and that were important, and so I think that the award show reflected that.
And we're seeing the same thing in some of these DVDs that are out. Jarhead has just been released?
Yeah, Jarhead, Anthony Swofford's very great novel, transformed on the screen, which tells the story of, you know, what a jarhead or a marine, and kind of an insanity that incurs from basic training all the way to, you know, kind of quote-unquote war, when you're out in an action, and is it a war, is it not? Who the heck knows?
Right, and then the difficulty of reintegrating back into civilian life.
Yeah, the special edition of this DVD has a great feature called Semper Fi, and I think this is a huge issue, and that is what happens when these guys come home.
Right.
And there's a whole thing on the news last night about VA hospitals and mm-hmm. the amount of days for care. It's a real issue, and I think this film really addresses a lot of it.
Yeah, the war does come home. I mean, that's it's an old cliche, but the war always does come home. Operation Dreamland, a new documentary.
Yeah, this won an American Independent Spirit Award, and it looks at the 82nd Airborne during the winter of 2004, trying to keep order in Fallujah. And basically, you know, it looks at what is it the realities of being an occupier in an occupied area. Really just jaw-dropping. There's just an amazing look, very raw, very not like the stuff you've seen from the embedded footage.
Mm-hmm. Operation Dreamland, that is. And then finally, we have about a half a minute. Lolly Love?
Yeah, Lolly Love. Jenna Fischer from The Office directed this really painfully funny mockumentary, which looks at the whole issue of charity and pretty much celebrity charity, when celebrities do charities that are more to show how much they care than to help people out. And I think it's well-timed when you look at all the aftermath of what has happened with aid to Katrina and the way in which people, you know, show their help, but when people need the help, what actually happens. It's a really funny documentary.
So this is a documentary that's sort of about, like, George Bush showing up down in Louisiana and saying, give me a hammer, let me nail some nails.
Well, they do it as a mockumentary, and what they do is they give lollipops to homeless people to cheer them up.
Oh, jeez. So. Amazing. And with Jenna Fischer, Lolly Love. Jeffrey, thank you so much. Jeffrey Kleinman, DVDTalk.com, the website. Jeffrey, the editor, thanks a lot for being with us, Jeffrey, and sharing
thanks,
your information. Always great having you on. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann program.
And welcome back, my friends. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. 1-866-440-8466. In just a moment, we'll be going to your phone calls. But first, a conservative alert. Why is it, many have wondered, that the Chris Matthews hardball program has been going farther and farther to the Reich as time goes by? Back as Media Matters for America points out, during a 2003 episode of Hardball, Matthews told Republican pollster Frank Luntz, quote, I'm more conservative than people think I am. By the way, I voted for President George W. Bush. In 2005, he said the Bush glimmers with that kind of sunny nobility, and that everybody sort of likes the president except for the real whack jobs. And that if Bush succeeds in creating a democracy in Iraq, he belongs on Mount Rushmore. These and others caused Media Matters for America to crown him Misinformer of the Year, bumping off Bill O'Reilly. In January, Republican conservatives led Democrat progressives 55-34 on Chris's show as guests, a difference of 59-41%. By February, that advantage had increased for the Republicans up to 62-38%. It was 59% were Republicans in January, 62% were Republicans in February. So why? A lot of people have been scratching their head. What's going on? Could it be that he really just is a conservative, even though he used to be a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter? Well, now the raw story. An article filed by John Byrne. New report suggests that Chris Matthews has accepted hefty speaking fees from an array of conservative trade associations. And Dave Johnson, who blogs the Seeing the Forest blog and is also a fellow at the Progressive Commonweal Institute, could find no records indicating that Matthews has spoken before any progressive or Democratic-leaning organizations. However, he has spoken for and presumably been paid perhaps as much as $50,000 a shot. Who knows? We don't know. It's not disclosed, but has spoken for, and these things are not cheap and they're not free, generally. The International Franchise Association, the National Association of Chain Drug Stores, the National Association of Convenience Stores, the American Hospital Association, the Consumer Healthcare Products Association, the National Venture Capitalists Association, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the Credit Union National Association, American Association of Society of Association Executives, and the International Health and Racket and Sports Club Association. In addition, he spoke to the Conservative in 2002, the Conservative Political Action Committee Conference, and in 2003, the Building Contractors Association. In 2005, Log Cabin Republicans National Convention. None of these associations, all of these associations have given heartily and heavily to conservative candidates for political office. So maybe it just has to do with, which side your bread's buttered on. Who knows? Who knows? Interesting story. 1-866-440-8466. Sandy in Seattle. Hey, Sandy, what's on your mind today?
That Chris Matthews, you know what? He can go and give a lecture on the maxi pad aisle. Maybe they'll pay. Girly man. But I was wondering if you read the Seattle Times, they have this man, Aaron Dixon, and he is running on the Green Party ticket for the U.S. Senate.
I don't know of him.
I didn't know. I did not know. I guess he was a former Panther leader, a little bit too much older for me to understand, know who he is or anything, but I read the article, and I guess in the 60s up here, he formed the Panther chapter, and back when it probably wasn't too cool to do so, he started the freelance programs and did all these types of things, and they were saying that he was probably going to take votes away from Cantwell and things like that, and he said he didn't care because she votes like a Republican anyway, but I was kind of seeing if you knew anything about him and what was your opinion.
I don't, Sandy. Aaron Dickinson, or Dixon, is somebody I'm just not familiar with. I'm sorry. So I'll look around and do a little research. And I appreciate your calling. Thank you very much for that. Jay in Seattle. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Well, great show, Tom. I had a slogan for you. I thought you might kind of like to hear.
We've had a few suggestions over the last few days.
Yeah. It goes like this. Leaders, yes. Rulers, no. The neocons have got to go.
Ooh, nice one. You know, I saw yesterday I had a car in front of me, and the bumper sticker said, "When Clinton lied, nobody died."
Yeah, that's right, too, you know.
That's one of my old favorites. That's just a classic, you know.
Yep, better web than red.
There you go. Thanks a lot,
have
Jay.
Have a great day.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Pam in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Pam, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention you were speaking in your last hour about port security.
Yes.
And the options seeming to be just for Halliburton if it's going to be stateside.
Well,
and
that's the name that a number of people are suggesting.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's
kind of
that's
people
what
on the inside
out there by, you know, and the government wants us to believe that that's the only option.
Sure.
But I've heard that of other companies, and I was just trying to Google it now. There's one that Senator Robert Menendez. From New Jersey, the Democrat. He was talking on a show that was on Air America a couple days ago, and he when he was a representative, was in port security, part of a committee on port security for 12 years.
Hmm.
So he knows a lot about this. And he was referring to a company, it starts with a B.
Bechtel?
Not Bechtel. One that you wouldn't normally have heard of.
Okay.
And they do cutting-edge work. They have a web page. They're great. I was in the car at the time. This is the problem. And I couldn't write down what the name of the company was. And
the bottom line, though, is, Pam, in this administration, people only get government contracts if
exactly.
they are politically connected or if they give big campaign contributions.
Exactly. But I thought it was important for you or for us somehow to put out there that, you know, there are other options. You know,
well, there are ports all over the United States. I mean, we have, what, 38 ports, I believe?
Yeah.
And, you know, a few of them are still run by the local municipalities or local governments. A lot of them are run by private companies, and
right.
they're not, and many of them are not overseas corporations.
Right.
And none of them, to the best of my knowledge, are being run by Halliburton right now.
Yeah, and this company is a United States company. It is very progressive. It offers all sorts of really good stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, let's explore other options before we go sending stuff to Halliburton. And I think people need to speak up to their representatives and their senators and say, look, you know, there's other options. We want these explored. Don't just sit there and tell us there's either
Pam, it goes way beyond this. The Department of Defense, Don Rumsfeld's Department of Defense, just uh-huh. decided that they're not going to investigate the overcharges that the Defense Department's own internal auditors found. The illegal overcharges that Halliburton has committed. This was announced last week. We talked briefly about it on the show here.
Yeah.
They say, you know, we're not even going to look into this stuff. What is necessary is to have somebody in Washington, D.C., who has the authority to call somebody like Halliburton before them and with the
yeah.
power of a subpoena say, you will testify under oath. And right now, right at this moment, the only group in Washington, D.C. that has the power to force somebody to testify under oath are the Republicans. They control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House, they control the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't do these kind of inquiries, but that's it. And so really what we need to be doing in all of these regards, Pam, is we need to be doing everything we can to get Democrats elected to the House and Senate
yes.
in 2006.
Oh,
and
yes,
and
I
if
do
you've
agree
got
with that, and I am working on it too.
Yeah, if you've got good Democrats in your area, then you know that's fine. You know, send some money to Democratic candidates elsewhere who need it. And if not, do you know, show up and hang out and help out and do whatever you can to help them get elected. Pam, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah,
it's good
thank you, Tom, for everything you're doing.
Sure enough, good to hear from you, Mike in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. One of my former coworkers, she just had a baby in June and got called to the Navy. She's in reserve, going to be called up for a year, and which to me signals that the Iranian thing is heating up. Have you thought about at that time if we're distracted with Iran, that is a good opportunity for China to invade Taiwan or some other things to happen in the world?
Yeah, the some other things to happen in the world is a certainty. I mean, you know, look at you know what Russia was doing, you know, with the former Soviet bloc countries, for example, when we were going into Iraq. But whether, frankly, I don't think that China is going to try and take Taiwan by violence. I think the downside is so great to them, you know, that they're not going to do that. What they're going to do is they're going to keep the doors open. They're going to keep exploring this, and they're going to, you know, their plan is to gradually absorb Taiwan. And frankly, Taiwan's official plan up until just a few weeks ago was to be officially absorbed once China becomes more democratic. Problem is that, you know, China has a multi-thousand-year history of dynasty, and it may be that to rule a land that big, it requires a dynasty. I don't know. You've got all these different disparate ethnic groups and languages and religions and everything else. But in any case, I don't think that the Chinese are going to become a democracy that we would recognize. And you know, instead what they're doing is they're just simply merging their version of communism with capitalism. So I don't think they're going to go after Taiwan. It's the bottom line, Mike.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Sure. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. There's just too much of a downside to it. But you never know. You never know. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy. What a great idea to the United States of America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against
disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And welcome back. The Bush administration has appointed 28-year-old White House staffer Doug Holscher as the executive director of the Homeland Security Advisory Committees. Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Holscher, this, how does a 28-year-old guy whose only experience before this is a $30,000-a-year job as a travel agent end up as the guy who, according to a press release from the Department of Homeland Security, will now be providing strategic counsel to Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff? In fact, here's exactly what the press release said. The department relies heavily on the expertise and advice of our advisory committees, said Stuart Baker, Assistant Secretary of Policy. Outside perspectives benefit the policy and decision-making process, and the administration has named a qualified and talented professional to cultivate these partnerships. That professional, Doug Holscher. Doug will provide strategic counsel to the secretary and increase overall coordination between department leadership and our Homeland Security partners, and I look forward to his contributions and counsels. He's going to gather expert advice on behalf of the president and the Homeland Security secretary from 20 other advisory boards covering key areas of Homeland Security, including threats to infrastructure and preventing terrorist attacks that use weapons of mass destruction. Now, how is it that a guy... And, you know, not to slam anybody who's 28 years old, but he hasn't been in the job market that long and came to government in 2001 as a low-level staffer, a travel agent, earned $30,000 a year. This is his first job, earned $30,000 a year. And, again, you know, the earnings of somebody, no reason to trash them. University of Iowa political science major, started working at the age of 25. Well, the way you do it is if you are the travel agent for George W. Bush. If you're the guy that Bush happens to know, you're the guy who handles all of his domestic travel. You're the guy who coordinates his domestic travel. You're the guy who probably knows you on a first-name basis. You walk into his office, you sit down with him, you say, okay, you want to go here, you want to go there, where do you want to stay, what do you want to do? That's what he's been doing for $30,000 a year. He's been the travel manager, the personal travel manager for George W. Bush. And so now, this travel agent, see, this is like handling, you know, pulling together information from 20 advisory boards covering key areas of Homeland Security, including threats to infrastructure and preventing terrorist attacks that use weapons of mass destruction. He's in charge of this and reporting directly to Michael Chertoff, providing him with counsel and leadership. I think that there's a characteristic of George W. Bush that has been often held up as either neutral or as an asset, that, you know, this guy, he's loyal to his friends, he's loyal to his family, and to quack. I think that what it is that when he identifies somebody that he knows is never going to, let me back up a little bit. I remember years ago I was doing consulting work for one of the largest hotel chains in America, and I was working with one of their senior vice presidents, and this guy and I were having lunch one afternoon. And he made a comment to me about one of the people who worked for him that was rather depreciating. And I said, well, why don't you replace her with somebody better? And he smiled and he said, I never hire anybody smarter than me because they represent a threat to me. And I thought, you know, that's really tragic. In my business life, I'd always tried to hire people smarter than me because they could make me money. They could do a good job. I mean, they could get out there and do things. But in the corporate world, and Bush said, you know, he's going to be a CEO president. And so that's not to say that Doug is dumb, but he's apparently loyal. Ken in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ken, we got a couple minutes left. What's on your mind today?
this is terrible. This guy is this enough to make you hurl, I'll tell you. 28 years old and going to bring all this together? Not a chance. And when it goes bad, they're going to, hi, you're doing a great job, Brownie, too.
Yeah.
All they're doing is picking the next name to go down in flames in front of the bus.
Yeah, it may well be. It may well be, Ken.
Come on, he can't. 28, give me a break.
Yeah, yeah. It may well be. I'm not quite all that Machiavellian as you are, Ken. I'm not convinced that Bush is trying to set this kid up. I think he's just, you know, he's afraid to have anybody around him that he can't completely dominate or control. And this young man, he's not a child, 28 years old. This young man has demonstrated that he is capable of being loyal and doing exactly what Bush tells him to do, which, you know, in some ways is a good set of characteristics.
Yeah, but Bush isn't picking on this kid. He doesn't care who he picks on. Hey, you're the next one.
Yeah, it may well be. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Good and interesting point. But it's really pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. And here's the final sellout from the Bush administration. The Christopher Reeve paralysis bill, the day after Chris Reeve died, it was passed unanimously through the House of Representatives. Republicans in the Senate put a hold on it. And now that his wife has died, apparently the Republicans have killed it. This is a bill, it has nothing to do with stem cells. This is a bill that would have furthered research into paralysis and improving rehabilitation and quality of life for those with spinal cord injuries. Amazing. Special thanks today to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark and Dan Jacobs at Air America, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. We'll see you again next week, my friends. Remember, democracy begins with you.
Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.